Now we're holding on page Dalid in Bava Kamma, the paragraph labeled Daf Lamed Aleph Toshma, middle of Os Zayin. It's on page Dalid, the second to last paragraph. Okay, so we were talking about the third parak of Bava Kamma talks about various cases where a person dropped something in Rishus HaRabim and to what extent is he responsible for the damages that come from that. Also, in that connection, if a person himself tripped and other people tripped over him, so the Gemara has a whole discussion about various things involving that. So, for example, yeah, if a person tripped in Rishus HaRabim, is that itself considered carelessness? And now he can be chayev if other people come and trip over him. He's responsible for the damages to them and to Kalim, or maybe not. Maybe it's considered an onus, and therefore he can't be chayav for that. So the Gemara has a whole discussion about the ins and outs of that. So in that connection, the Gemara brings Toshma. Let's bring a proof from the following case. Hakadorim v'azagogin shoyim mahalchin zehazeh. Kadorim are potters, so they're carrying their pots. Zagogim are glaziers, so they're carrying pane, they're carrying panes of glass or glass kalim or whatever. Shoyim mahalchin zehazeh. They're walking one behind the other. Nitkala Rishon v'nafal. Now suppose the first one trips and falls. V'nitkala Sheni b'Rishon, and you have a pile up over here. You have a multi-car pile up, except it's with people. So the second one then trips over the first one. V'agimul nitkala Sheni, and then the third one trips over the second one. So the din will be Harishon chayev b'nizke Sheni. The first one who tripped will be chayev for the damages of the second one. Vasheni chayev nizke shlishi, and the second one will be chayev in the nizakim of the third one, because in other words, each one is responsible for what's going on behind him, because as we're going to go on to say, they should warn one another. The first one, when he trips, should yell out to the guy behind him, stop and don't keep going because I fell. So if he didn't, then we can hold him responsible. V'im machmas harishon naflu, if they all fell because of the first one. Harishon chayev b'nizke kulam, then the first one will be chayev in the nizakin of all of them. The Gemara brings one possibility. How would all of them have fallen as a result of the first one? One possibility is, for example, Gemara says, is let's say, for example, different people tripped over different parts of him. You have a few people walking, side by side. So, well, first you have Reuven walking in front, and he tripped and fell, and now he's sprawled across the street over there. And now you have Shimon and Levi and Yehuda, let's say, all walking side by side, and Shimon trips over Reuven head and Levi over his midsection and Yehuda over his legs, so all of them have tripped directly because of him. So then Chayev Harishon Chayev Beniske Kolam. So then he's going to be Chayev in the Nizakim of all of them. V'imiziru Zes Zep Turin. However, if each one of them, any one of them, warned the other one, stop because I fell, put Turin, then they're Potcher because then he did what he could to prevent the other one from falling. So it's a din, and again, the Gemara goes on to discuss the various ins and outs of these dinim, but Habboina, at the bottom of the page here, points out that there is a lesson from this, which is why it's included in Ein Yaakov. There's a hurrah to leaders in the community that a person is responsible for what he could have prevented, the fact that he could have prevented other people from doing Averis by giving them Musa, by warning them away. If he doesn't, then he can be held responsible, and that's the lesson of this thing over here, where because the first one himself stumbled, as in fell into an Avera, he should at least take the opportunity to warn others not to fall into that trap as well. Further on, the Gemara continues later on in the Perek talking about, suppose you have a person running down the street and he bangs into somebody else and injures him. So then, generally we say, Tanya, we learn in a Braise, Isi ben Yehudoimer, Rotz Chayev Neshul Mashuna. So the one who's running is going to be Chayev because he's doing something unusual. In other words, maybe you have two people both walking innocently along and one of them bangs into the other. He wouldn't necessarily be held responsible for that because, depending on the circumstances, you could have, for example, let's say they're both rounding a corner and coming in opposite directions, they won't necessarily have seen each other. But here, if one of them is running, what's he doing? Running in Rosh Hashanah, and that's being careless, and therefore we can hold him responsible for the damages that he caused. However, Isi ben Yehuda will agree that Erev Shabbos ben Ashmoshes shehu potter, that if it's Erev Shabbos ben Ashmoshes late in the day on Erev Shabbos, then he's potter with Meshur Roth Berushus v'chola. Because then, as the Gemara goes on to say, then he's running Berushus, because then he has permission to be running L'Kovet Shabbos to get his errands done before Shabbos. The post can bring this, first of all, there is, from this you have the concept, the expression mitzvah lotus, the Erev Shabbos comes based on this Gemara. And in fact, they talk about it can be even, we don't just mean Erev Shabbos ben Hashemoshes, like the last few moments of Friday, it can actually mean even from Erev Shabbos, after Chatzos and on, anytime after Chatzos, provided that it really is something that the running is going to help you get it accomplished faster. If it's not, then Sam, you're running like a Meshuggah, then you can still be held responsible. So the Gemara discusses the Erev Shabbos, my Birshus Ika. What exactly is the Birshus that you're allowed to run on Erev Shabbos? What is there that has to be done on Erev Shabbos that makes it that you'd be allowed to run and then that you'd be allowed to run in Rishus Rabim and you'd be potter from any injuries you cause because of that? So the answer is Kedirab Chanina, like Rab Chanina says. Da'am Rab Chanina, as Rab Chanina would tell people when before Shabbos, Boyu v'netzeh v'kras kala malkasa, come and let us go out in honor to welcome the bride, the queen, which is Shabbos. So therefore, we're not just talking about to prepare for Shabbos. Here he's saying that they're going to be going out to welcome Shabbos. From this you have the Arizal had the Minag with his Talmidim that they would go out into the fields to welcome Shabbos. And this is where we have the line Boi Chala that we say at the end of the Chodori at all. It's all based on this Gemara. But Amilah, the Kras Shabbos Kala Malkasa. Another version is that Rav Chanina would specify and say that it's an honor of Shabbos, the bride, the queen. Interestingly, by the way, when the Rambam brings this halacha, he says he actually formulates it as Shabbos HaMelech. He says Shabbos the king. So it seems that Rambam may have had a Giusa in our Gemara over here, not Malkasa the queen, but Malka, which would be the king. Bechlal, we usually talk about Shabbos in the name word Shabbos itself is feminine. We talk all over the place in Kabbalah and in Chassidus that Shabbos is associated with Malchus, which is feminine. So that's why we're using this expression. Marsha also refers to a medrash that says that the Shabbos complained to Hashem. Said every other day of the week has a partner. One way of looking at it is they partner adjacent days. Sunday pairs up with Monday, Tuesday with Wednesday, Thursday with Friday. Another way of looking at it is they pair up across the week. For example, Sunday and Wednesday, both of them Hashem created things in the heavens. Tuesday, Monday and Thursday is both things created on earth and so forth. So each one in that sense has a match with the other one, but Shabbos says, I'm lonely, I have no pair. So Hashem tells him, Knesset Yisrael, the Jewish people, will be your mate. So therefore Shabbos is the queen, so therefore Shabbos is the queen, and we're like the king, and every week there's like a wedding. So therefore, it's like we're bringing in the kala into the chuppah, and therefore, and the same way, we make kiddush, you have kiddushin by a wedding. Marshall explains, you have kiddushin by a wedding, and then that, with that, the wedding is made official, the husband and wife now unite, now you have the same thing, kiddush on Shabbos accomplishes the same thing as far as Shabbos. So now he would say, come, let's go out and welcome the queen, the bride, the queen. Rav Yanai, instead of going out, would wrap himself in his nice clothing, the koyan, and he would stand in place, the omer, and he would say, boi chala, come bride, come bride. So, Marsha explains, because there's both, really. On the one hand, we have, the chosin goes to welcome the kala. Therefore, Rav Chanina was following that. He would go out, he and his talmidim would go out to welcome Shabbos, like the chosin goes towards the bride. And then on the other hand, Rabbi Yanai would stay in place and the kala would come to him like you have after the chuppah where the kala leaves her father's house and comes to her chosin's house to live there. And that's therefore, your Marsha says, that's why he uses the double expression, boi chala, first one time come to the chuppah and then come to your husband's house to us Jewish people's house.
Yom Tov also
isn't
going
around. So it doesn't say Yom Tov, maybe because Yom Tov there are certain malachas that you're allowed to do on Yom Tov itself, so maybe it's not the same thing, but I don't know. Anyway, so the point is, with all of this, so they do have a right then to be running around to prepare for Shabbos and to go out and greet Shabbos. So we actually have, you know, we have in Chododi, we say Bo Yichala twice, and then we say the third time, silent, quietly, Bo Yichala Shabbos Malkasa. So the two times again. So you have, first of all, Marsha explaining over here that the two times represent the two stages in a Kala. First, she comes to the Chuppah, and then she comes to her husband's house. So the same way, like first Shabbos is coming to our Kiddush, and then she's coming to our houses. But there's also the idea, the two boichalos that we say out loud represent Chochmah and Bina, Abba ve'Ima, father and the mother, and then the third one silently is Das. So therefore we say it silently because you have Chochmah and Bina are the main thing. Das is then the thing that connects them together. So we say it, but we say it quietly because it's like on a different level than them. But then we declare Shabbos Malkasa, Shabbos the Queen, like you in the Gemara. Okay. So the next parak continues, starts talking in great detail about the various cases where an ox gores and how much the owner of the ox owes and all the various details in that. So one thing the Gemara discusses in the course of all those dinim is when we talk about certain cases of payments for Nezakin. Now in those times they had two different systems of currency that were in use. They were called Kesef Tsuri and Kesef Medina. Kesef Tsuri is the silver coinage that they minted in the city of Tsur, Tyre, which nowadays is in Lebanon. It was a big trading center in the ancient world. Chiram Melech Tsur helped and provided materials for David's and Shlomo's palaces and for the Beis Mikdash and so forth. It was like the Wall Street of ancient times. Anyway, so there they minted coins in the times of the second Beis Mikdash, and afterwards they minted coins there that were almost pure silver. So those are called Kesef Tsuri. Then on the other hand, the Gemara discusses, you had a different system called Kesef Medina. You had silver coinage that was struck elsewhere in the provinces where only 1/8 of it was silver and the rest was copper. They still would be denominated the same. So you'd have a sella, you have a certain coin called a sella in the Tsuri system and also in the Medina system. But because back then coins were considered to be only as valuable as the metal that they contained, therefore sella Medina would be worth 1/8 of a sella Tsuri. And the same thing with all the other denominations. So the Gemara goes into some discussion about which one is to be used for paying for various kinds of damages. It talks about certain cases where we know that if a person injures somebody else, he's chayav for up to five types of payments. And among them are boishes. You have to pay for the embarrassment. You have certain cases where the chachamim set up like fixed amounts that you have to pay, that a person has to pay for certain kinds of very common, not so much injuries, but more like insults. Like, for example, kicking somebody or slapping him or yelling in his ear, as we're going to have in the Gemara over here, Tekei al Chaveiroi, where Rashi says two possibilities. One is that he boxes his ears, he hits him on the ear. The other is that he yells or blows a trumpet into his ear. So those kinds of things. I mean, there's not really a nezek per se, but there's really just a little boishes and, you know, maybe a little temporary discomfort. So the Chachamim set up fixed amounts that have to be paid for those, which includes, that'll include the boishes and that'll include everything else. So the question is, are those amounts in sellout in the Tsuri system or in the Medina system? So in this connection, the Gemara brings Tanan Hossam. We learn in a Mishnah later on in the Masechta, Hatekeya l'chaveri noisim loisela v'cholo. If somebody is tekeya to somebody else, then he has to pay him a sela. And again, tekeya can either mean that he boxes him in the ears, or it can mean that he yells in his ears. So then he pays him a sela, and so the Gemara is discussing the question, what kind of sela? In the end, the Gemara concludes that it's a sela medina, which again would be 1/8 of a sela Tsuri. It's a relatively small amount. It would be equivalent. There's a parenthetical note over here in Rashi that it comes out to be the equivalent of half a zuz in the Tsuri system. And because you have this four dinar to a sela, a dinar is also known as a zuz. If a sela medina is worth 1/8 of a sela Tsuri, then it comes out it's worth half a dinar or half a zuz in that system. But in the Medina system, it's called the sela. So the Gemara tells a story in this connection. Chanan Bisha, Chanan the Bad, they called him that because, as we're going to see from this story, he was not a nice guy. Tokalelahu Gavra. One time he did that, he did the toka to somebody else. He boxed his ears or yelled in his ears or whatever. Also, so the case was brought to Rav Huna. So Rav Huna tells him, go give him the half of zuz, the half of 30 zuz, which is going to be equivalent to a sela medina. Now, havalei zuzah mocha. This Chanan Bisha had a worn out zuz. Rashi says in particular, mocha means p'chusa tsurose. The image on the coin was like mashed up. It was like the coin had been used for a long time, and the image on it was not so clear anymore. Now, the problem is such a thing is not readily going to circulate. You take it to a store, they may be willing to accept it, but not necessarily. It's like the equivalent of nowadays. If you were to come to a store with a dollar bill that's half ripped, they might accept it, they might not. So this was kind of the equivalent of that. So Chonon wanted to give this guy, the victim, he was going to give him this worn out zuz, and the guy would give him a half a zuz as change. But the guy wasn't willing to accept it, because what am I going to do with this worn out coin? No storekeepers are going to be willing to accept it. So what's Chonon going to do? He's a smart guy. He gave the guy another zetz in the ear, and then he gave him the coin. And then at this point, the guy basically apparently had no choice but to accept it. So what's the lesson from this? So Ben Yehoyada points, first of all, Boina at the bottom of the page here points out that look at this. You have a person who is a Rosha and then compounds his rishos, like here over here, Chonon Bisha first hit the guy and then he compounded it by hitting him again just so he could give him this worn out coin. Ben Yehoyada points out there's a couple of other lessons that we can learn from this. One of them is indeed the practical halacha, that indeed it is a half a sela in the tzodi system, as which Ravuna tells him to pay. But he points out a couple of other things as well. One of them is, why do we still call the guy Bisha after that? We still call him Chon the Bad after all, he paid for it. And the reason is because he's obviously not regretful for what he did, as we see that he did the same thing again just so he could get rid of this useless coin. It does have to be, Ben Yehoyada points out, it can't be that it was completely useless, otherwise the guy's taka not obligated to accept it. It would be, again, like the ripped up bill. You'll find some store will be willing to accept it, this won't necessarily be so easy. The Gemara mentions this Chonon Bisha in another context as well, that he was a tough guy. One time he stole something, the Gemara says, it's later in the Masechta actually, the Gemara says that he's not known for stealing. He's known for being a tough guy and hitting people or whatever, but not necessarily does he have a chazaka of stealing. So even a guy like that is not necessarily, he still basically has a cheskes kashrus, in other words. There is an interesting thing, actually. Tosfos points out elsewhere in the Gemara, it mentions that Rav Huna himself, when there was a person who hit somebody else, now the Gemara elsewhere tells us in Sanhedrin that one Yid who hits another, a person lifts up a hand against a fellow Yid, is called a Rosha. And the Gemara tells over there in Sanhedrin where one time Rav Huna sentenced a person who hit other people to have his hand chopped off. So Tosfos says, why don't you do it to the Chonon Bisha over here? And the answer is because he didn't yet have a chazaka of it. He did it again to this guy and gave him the coin, but he didn't yet have a chazaka of doing this again and again. If he did, then yes, this Rav Huna would probably have sentenced him also to having his hand chopped off. It's more that this guy, because he's doing this habitually, if the only way to stop him is he's not going to be dissuaded by having to pay money or whatever, so then if the only way to do it is to chop off his hand to prevent him from doing it again, then that's what you do. In a similar vein, by the way, it's interesting, there's a tshuva from the Rosh. The Rosh lived most of his life in Germany. He was one of the top talmidim of the Maharam Rutenberg. Then he was forced to escape Germany because they were threatening to arrest him like they did Maharam Rutenberg. So he and his whole family escaped and left behind all their wealth and went to Spain. And the Rashba got him a job as the Rav of Toledo. Nevertheless, the Rosh and his family still had a difficult time of it for many years. Anyway, so the Rosh, in Toledo over there, he's the Rav, and people are sending him shilas from all over the place. So at one point, a kahila in Spain sent him a question. There's a Yid in our town who's regularly cursing Hashem, and even the Goyim consider that to be a horrible thing to do. And they actually gave, the government has actually given us permission to execute people. Should we do that? So the Rosh says, Dini Nefashis, we don't judge Dini Nefashis nowadays. I hear the government has given you permission. Listen, if you figure we have no choice, if you're going to get in trouble with the government, if we're not, then I guess go ahead, but it's not really the right thing to do. If you want, then cut out the guy's tongue. So sometimes you have to take extreme measures. A person is using a certain body part for the wrong purpose, then, you do what you have to. The next piece in Ein Yaakov over here is has to do with so like this the uh, um The Mishnah goes on to describe, again, you have these cases of oxen goring one another. The Mishnah establishes like this. We know that between Jews, as we've talked about, if the ox is a tam, it's only done it one or two times, then you only pay chatzi nezek. If it's a muad, if it's habitually does this three or more times, then you pay nezek sholim. Now, a Mishnah says like this. On the other hand, it's not like that between a Jew and a goy. The Mishnah says, if a Jew's ox gores a goy's ox, then the Jew is potter. And on the other hand, if the goy's ox gores a Jew's ox, he's always paying nezek sholem. There's none of this tam and muad business. But Rambam gives a logical reason behind it, which is in the first case, the goyim don't necessarily hold owners, at least the goyish law in those times, they wouldn't necessarily hold the owner responsible for what his ox does. So therefore, we can say if a yid gores a goy's ox, so what do you want? In your laws, I would be potter. So therefore, I'm entitled to be potter. And the other way around, then on the other hand, we would penalize him so that he takes care of his ox better. The Gemara actually associates it, though. The Gemara gives a reason associating it with the fact that the goyim refused to accept the Torah, as we have in this week's parasha. Hashem Misinai Bov Zorach Miseir Lomar, Hefiya Mahar Paran, he went to Seir, he went to Paran, he went to all the nations to offer them the Torah, and they all turned it down. They're not even keeping Shev Mitzvahs and Enoyach, so therefore Hashem, to a certain extent, was mafkir their money. So the Gemara goes and discusses some various details involving that, and then, so I want to tell over here, it's interesting, I don't know why Ein Yaakov didn't include the following piece, but I'm gonna tell it over outside, because it's a very interesting thing, and there's a lot of interesting things that we can learn from it. The Gemara tells, and it also has to do again with our parasha. The Sifri tells a version of the story having to do with the pasuk in our parasha Achoy Vavamim. So the Sifri tells the story first, and before we get to the Gemara's version of it, the Sifri tells the story that at one point the Roman government sent two soldiers to pose as prospective gerim and go learn the Torah. They wanted to find out. They wanted to get inside information on what the Jewish people and their Torah is all about. So the Sifri tells, they sent two soldiers to pose as prospective gerim, and they sent to go to Rav Gamliel and learn Torah from him. So they did, and Rav Gamliel taught them. Then eventually they told him who they really are. We're not here as prospective gerim. We're here on a mission from the government. They tell him, we like everything we heard from your Torah, except for a couple of things, and one of them is this din from our Mishnah about the Jew versus the goy as far as the ox and goring. We consider that to be unfair. However, they tell Rav Gamliel, we'll do you a favor, and we won't tell that over in our official report to the emperor. We won't include that detail. So now all Gemara tells the story as well, but all Gemara tells it with a twist. It doesn't say that they pretended to be Gerim. It just says that they came to Rav Gamliel as soldiers and demanded to be taught Torah. Which actually then the Tosfos wonders in that case, how is Rav Gamliel allowed to teach them Torah? And a couple of answers. One of them is you're not required. We know you're not allowed to teach Torah to Goyim. One answer in Tosfos is because he's not required to be Moser Nefesh to avoid that. The other answer is that we should follow the version in the Sifri that they were pretending to be prospective Goyim. Anyway, the same thing in the Gemara, they say we don't like this one din, but we're not going to complain to the government about it. The Yerushalmi also tells the story and adds a detail. The Yerushalmi says the Eved Shtehelt that before they even reached the border of Eretz Yisrael on their way back to Rome, they'd forgotten everything they learned. Anyway, an interesting point in that connection then is the Yamshel Shloima, the Marshal on Or Gemara, points out, he says, given the version in Or Gemara, that they had shown themselves to begin with to be Goyim, and that they're demanding to be taught the Torah so they can make an official report to the Roman government of what the Jews believe and what they practice. So how is Rav Gamliel going and teaching them this halacha? Isn't there the tremendous danger involved? The whole Jewish people could be in danger as a result of it. You're going to say, Mela, in the version of the Sifri, fine, he didn't know, he thought that they're Goyim, but in the version in Or Gemara, if he knows that they're Goyim, how is he teaching them such a halacha, and how does he know that they're going to say, we'll be nice guys? And the Marshal says from this an amazing thing. He says, you learn from this, that even if it's a matter of pikuach nefesh, you cannot falsify anything in the Torah. If that's the din in the Torah, that the Torah, in, to that extent, discriminates between Jews and Goyim, then you have to say it out, and you can't pretend that it's otherwise, just to be politically correct. There might be a danger to the Jewish people, says the Yamshel Shloima, doesn't matter. That was something else. That was they translated the Torah for him. Right. So one of the answers is, in fact, that you're allowed to teach them Torah Shemachsav, just not Torah Shemalpeh, but here Rav Gamliel is teaching them Torah Shemalpeh as well, because of the din in Torah Shemalpeh. But yeah. And there is quite a bit of discussion about all the ins and outs of these dinim of teaching Torah to Goyim. One thing is, as Tosfos says over here, you're not required to be Moser Nefesh to avoid it. You also have, for example, you have cases where, for example, a person, let's say, back in the day on the radio and later on TV and, nowadays on the internet or whatever, you broadcast things of Torah, and of course, Goyim can listen to them too. Rav Moshe has a tshuva about it. He says it's not a problem. You're pitching it to Jews. The fact that Goyim can tune in as well doesn't matter. So now there's the piece that is in Ein Yaakov over here, in continuation of that. So now the Pnei Yeshua explains the connection between the part about the Goyim and their moment, and the next piece is as follows. We're saying that to a certain extent, Hashem was mafkir the moment of a Goy. Oh, the Sifri also adds an interesting detail, that one of the other halachas that these soldiers complained about to Rav Gamliel, they said, we don't consider this fair, is the concept that Gezel Goy Mutter, the concept in halacha, which is discussed later on in the Masechta, that in certain cases, it would be allowed to take something stolen from a Goy. So Rav Gamliel, so the Sifri says, Rav Gamliel on the spot made a takana, you can't because of Chilul Hashem. The Gemara later on in the Masechta discusses that whole point extensively, that the different opinions, whether in fact Gezel Goy is Mutter or Osir, but everybody agrees that where there's Chilul Hashem involved, then it's definitely Osir. In that connection, by the way, it's an interesting thing, the Be'er HaGoyla brings in this connection when these halachas are discussed in Shulchan Aruch and Choshen Mishpah. He mentions, you have people who would do that. They would figure Tos Goy Mutter, Gezel Goy Mutter, whatever, and they would cut corners and do things like that. He says, I know several such people who they ended up, they thought they'd gain a fortune from it. In the end, they lost everything they gained. Whereas a person who acts in an honest way and makes sure to be honest and to be above board with a goy just as much as with a yid, then he'll be successful. So now the Gemara continues. So now, having talked about this idea that to a certain extent Hashem was maskir the moment of goyim as far as this din of the oxen and all, so now the Gemara is going to discuss the Pnei Yeshua says where Moshe thought that in a similar way the property of the Moyavim and the Ammonim should be forfeit and the Jews should be allowed to take it freely and conquer their lands, and Hashem is telling him not so. So the Gemara tells Rav Shmuel bar Yehuda's shivalei brante. Rav Shmuel bar Yehuda's daughter passed away. Amri le Rabbanan la'ula, kum nezel ninachame. So the other Chachamim in Bavel said to Ula, who was visiting from Eretz Yisrael, come, let's go be menachem of him. Amalehu, but Ula answers them, my isle gabi nachamase de Bavloi, why should I go along with the comforts that of the type that they do in Bavel? Their kind of comforting, says Ula, is a blasphemy. It's an insult to Hashem. The Amri, because they say in Bavel, people popularly say, "My efshalay lemevad." What can you do? Like you say, it's inevitable. Well, you can't help it. What does that imply? How efshalay lemevad avdi? Does that imply, and if we could have done something, we would have? What do you got to accept the judgment of Hashem and not second guess it? So therefore, Ula considered it to be improper to say that. And in fact, in Shulchan Aruch, the Taka brings, you're not allowed to say it. On the other hand, the Maharshal disagrees and says that the halacha may well be like the Chachamim of Bavel, that you would be allowed to say such a thing. In any case, so Ozel Hu L'chudi L'gabei, so Ula decided to go on his own. He doesn't want to go with the Chachamim of Bavel, but he's going to go there to be Menachem Ovel on his own. This way he doesn't have to hear what they're saying, and then this way he doesn't have to deal with all that again. Omalei, so he and also this way he can say his own kind of nechama, which again the chacham above all might not necessarily approve of. Omalei, so he tells Rav Shmuel bar Yehuda, Ula tells Rav Shmuel bar Yehuda as follows. The Pasuk says, when the Jewish people are passing by Moav, Vayomer Hashem Elai, Hashem said to me, says Moshe, Al Totzeras Moav, do not harass Moav, Val Tisko Bam Nochama, and do not provoke war against them. Now, do we need that? Why would Moshe think to wage war without Hashem's permission? If Hashem doesn't tell him to go to war, he's not going to go to war. Why would Hashem have to warn Moshe against it as though Moshe is ready to go to war without first checking with Hashem anyway? Ella, what happened was over here, Nosam Moshe Kavachomer Ba'atzmai, because it means that Moshe made a Kavachomer. He was going to make a Kavachomer to think that it should be allowed. So Omar, he thinks to himself, well, ma minyonim shall it borrow ever Lazarus Moyov. Consider the minyonim later on in the story with Shittim and Baal Per, the minyonim came only to help Moyov, because you have Bolok when he wanted to curse the Jewish people, and Zikne Midyon went along with it, and later on you also have that later on we have Benois Midyon and Benois Moyov were involved when they were seducing the Jewish people. Omra Torah, and yet the Torah says Tsoras and Midyonim the Kisim Oisam, provoke the Midyonim and strike them and go to war against them, which eventually they did. So Moshe thinks to himself, my Ovim Atzmon, like Koshkin, how much more so than my Ovim themselves, who started all the trouble, that we should be entitled to go and fight against them. They started the whole trouble by hiring Vilam. Tosfos points out that it's not necessarily, we don't mean that Moshe actually made this Kal V'Chomer, but Moshe could have made this Kal V'Chomer if not for the fact that Hashem forestalled it by telling him, I'll Tatzar as Moyav. So it's not that Moshe first made this Kal V'Chomer, says Rabbi Natan, and then Hashem had to tell him, no, your Kal V'Chomer is wrong, means he didn't yet make this Kal V'Chomer, but Hashem tells him, I'll Tatzar as Moyav, and therefore later on Moshe realizes, well, in that case, then the Kal V'Chomer is baseless. So why is that? So not baseless, but Hashem tells him, I have other plans. So Amalei HaKadosh Baruch Hu loik sh'ol sal daiti cha'ol sal daiti. What you're thinking to go and strike and kill the Moyavim is not what I'm thinking. Shtei pridis tovus yeshli lahotzi mehem. I have two good doves to bring out from those nations. Rus haMoyavia v'nama haAmonis. Rus is going to descend from Moab. Nama is going to descend. Nama, who was one of the wives of Shlomo and was the mother of Rechavam, and therefore she's the ancestress of all the future kings of Malchus and David, including Mashiach. They're destined to come out from them. So I want their nations to be spared. Tosfos points out it doesn't really need to mention Moav over here, because Moshe wasn't really thinking of attacking Ammon in the first place. But once we're mentioning Moav, we mention Ammon together, because the two previous Tovas, they kind of go together. Two women from those nations, where the men of those nations are also to intermarry into the Jewish people, and the women are allowed to. Tosfos also points out, the fact is, there's also a difference. The Gemara explains in the next piece that there was a difference. With Moav, they were allowed to harass them. They were allowed to force them to do labor for them. Rashi mentions on the Pasuk, they were allowed to scare them by appearing in front of them fully armed and so forth, whereas Ammon and Edom, they're not even allowed to do that. So now Marsha points out later on we do find the time of the Shoftim, where in the time of the Shoftim we find that Moav fought against the Jewish people, and eventually Ehud killed the king over there, Eglon, and then they fought against Moav and decimated them. So what happened to what Hashem is saying over here? Marsha says evidently Rus must have been born by that point, so therefore it's not a problem. The Pri Tova has already come out. Which Marsha discusses over here, and Tosfos elsewhere discusses. The Gemara in some places says that Rus was a daughter of Eglon. Doesn't mean literally a daughter, or doesn't mean a descendant of. If it means a descendant, then you still have to ask. It's still a couple hundred years later. There is, by the way, I mean, the Gemara tells us in Baba Basra that Ivson, one of the later Shoftim, is identical with Boaz. In that case, that's about 200 odd years after the story with Ehud and Eglon. On the other hand, there are, I think, in Seder Olam, or there's different other places where there are different opinions that place the story of Boaz and Ruth much earlier, and in that case, it could work with her actually being Eglon's daughter. And the same thing, in David's time, they fought against Ammon, same thing, Nama must have been born by that point. Then Yehoyada brings up the point, so what? So Hashem can't arrange that they should fight against Ammon and Moab and wipe out those nations, but leave the one person or the few people from whom Rus and Nama respectively are going to descend? What would be the problem with that? And he gives a few answers, one of them being that you want not just that they should be, not just that they should descend from, you want those nations to still be identifiable at the time when Rus and Nama respectively come from them, and you want also that the royal families that they come from should also be identifiable. If most of the nation is wiped out and you only have a few stragglers left, then that's not going to be considered that they came from those nations and from those royal families. As far as Nama, by the way, an interesting point is you have the psukim that talk about Rechavam. He's portrayed very negatively. He and his people worship Avodah Zarah and did other Avedas. And it mentions again at the end of his, when it summarizes his reign, he ruled for X number of years and he passed away. And then it says again, "V'shem imay Nama ha'moynis." that his mother's name was Nama HaMoinis. So a number of the Mephoshim actually say that that means that Nama, that the reason why he was bad is because his mother, Nama, who came from Ammon, was a bad influence on him. So therefore, like the Pasuk needs to stress again, why was he so bad? Because his mother was Nama HaMoinis. On the other hand, you know, you have all Gemara over here, which seems to be putting her in the same breath as Rus, so she must not have been that bad after all. Then Yehoyada also brings an odd medrash that's brought in a few places. It's brought by the Ramami Fano, it's brought by the Chidon, and others that basically the gist of the story is that during the time, we know famously that Shloima had a period during his reign when he was kicked off the throne by Ashmedai. So there's a whole story how Nama found him and saved him and eventually restored him to his kingdom. But Ben Yehoyada says it doesn't seem to work out chronologically. Rechavam was her son, and he was 41 when he became king. Meanwhile, Shloima ruled for 40 years, meaning that Rechavam was born a year before Shloima even became king. So how could it be that we're talking about that only years later, when Shloima was kicked off the throne, that Nama helped save him and then he married her afterwards? So he says it doesn't really seem to work out. But in the case, there is apparently something positive enough about Nama that her whole nation was saved for her sake. So anyway, the Gemara continues. So what does this have to do with Nichum Avelim, to Rav Shmuel by Yehuda, for his daughter passing away? So Ola says, Valoi Dvorim Kavachoymer. Now you can make a Kavachoymer over here. Uma b'shvil shtei pridis tovus, madach for these two precious doves, for them, for their sake, Hashem had Rachmanos on two great nations, and didn't destroy them. Well then, Reb Shmuel by Yehuda, your daughter who just passed away, if she was kosher or ruil, he lots it in then a double tov. If she was fitting, if she was suitable, that something good would have come out from her. Alachas kam of a kamah to have a foyer. How much more so that Hashem would have kept her alive, and therefore you should realize that, in other words, the fact that Hashem that she passed away means that Hashem knew that nothing there's not going to be anything great coming from her, and therefore it's not such a great loss. Eon Yaakov actually says the loshen at the beginning shivale. Now you have the Gemara elsewhere talks about that there's a loshen, but you have by David HaMelech that says you have an expression in the pasuk that says that ki shochav David im avoysav v'chi meis yoyav saratzava. It's Gemara in Bava Basra. Based on a posuk in Malachim. It says that at one point an enemy of the Jewish people heard that David had lain with his fathers, had slept with his fathers, and Yoav the general had died. So why the difference? Why is David described as Shochav im Avosav and Yoav has died? So the Gemara says because David left over a son who was his equal, who was worthy to succeed him, Shloima. Yoav didn't leave over any children who are of his caliber. So we see that the word shiva is used of somebody who leaves over a child of their caliber. So Eon Yaakov, in fact, says it must mean that this daughter of Shmuel by Yehuda already had a daughter of her caliber, and therefore Ullah is telling him that, if there was more good destined to come from her, then Hashem would have kept her alive. Obviously, she fulfilled her purpose in the world by producing this one daughter who's her equal. Okay. So in any case, so that was his Nichum Avelim to Rav Shmuel by Yehuda to realize that Hashem, that each person, Hashem plans how long they should be in the world and what they need to accomplish, and then takes them when it's time. Continuing on this topic then of Rechavam, continuing on this topic of Moyav and Amon, Omer Rav Chiya Ba'aba, Omer Rav Yechonon, Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mekapeach Schar Kol Briya. Hashem does not cut off, does not withhold the schar for any creature, afilu schar sichana, even the schar that a person should get, just for speaking nicely and delicately, that deserves a reward from Hashem, and Hashem makes sure to pay back that reward. Because let's consider with these two daughters of Lot, who gave birth to these children who fathered the nations of Ammon and Moab respectively. The elder daughter called her son Moab, which is May of. He's from my father. So it's a princistic thing to openly state that it came from her father. So Hashem tells Moshe, don't provoke Moab, and do not provoke war, don't trouble Moab, and don't provoke war against them, implying you can't actually fight a full-scale war against them, but you can force them to do forced labor for you. And again, as Rashi says on the Pasuk, you can also appear in front of them in full battle dress and terrify them and so forth, and it worked, because as the Pasuk says, Moab and King Balak were terrified of them, and that's why they called for Bilam, and the whole story developed from there. Seira de Kamra Ben Ami, on the other hand, the younger daughter called the son Ben Ami, which is a more delicate way. He's a son of someone from my people, without specifying who. Amalei HaKadosh Baruch Hu Moshe, Hashem tells Moshe, V'karavta mul b'nei Ammon, when you come close to b'nei Ammon, al tetsureim, don't harass them, v'al tisko bam, and do not provoke them, klal, meaning at all, v'afilam galio letavid b'hu, you're not even allowed to make them do forced labor for you. So that was the schar of that younger daughter, because she used a more sneistic way in naming her son. On the other hand, but Rabbi Chiya Ba'aba also says, a person should always be faster to do the mitzvah. They thought they're doing a mitzvah because they thought the whole world was going to go extinct and they're the only survivors left. For the one night that the elder daughter went ahead and had relations with her father ahead of the younger one, for that she got to add that her descendant joined the Jewish people, joined the royal family 4 generations ahead of the next one. You have Rus became a Giyotis and married Boaz. You have from there Ovid, Yishai, V'David, Ushloima, V'ilatzira, and Rechavam. And now from the younger daughter from Ammon, it had to wait until that she's the mother of Rechavam, Dichtiv Hashem Imay Nama Hamonis. So we see that there were 4 generations difference in when Moav, and when the descendant of Moav joined the Jewish people versus when the descendant of Ammon did. So now, on the face of it, it seems to be contradictory. So was the older daughter doing the right thing, or was doing the better thing, or the worst thing? Marshall says, no contradiction. There's both. On the one hand, she was better in that she was faster, she was more eager to do the mitzvah. On the other hand, she acted in this, on the other hand, she talked in this pritzistic way, publicizing that it's from her father. So each one is midah keneged midah. Because she went first in the mitzvah, therefore she gets to be first to join the Jewish people. Because she didn't care for her father's covered and openly said that this child was from her father, therefore Hashem didn't care for their covered and allowed the Jewish people to use them for Angaria for forced labor.
Mashiach
still ultimately comes from, Mashiach comes from both Moav and Ammon, we're saying, because he descends from both Rus and Nama, yeah. I've told before in this year the story involving Moshe Feinstein and one of his balabatim that's told in the introduction to one of the volumes of Igros Moshe, where a balabas in his neighborhood had spoken very negatively against these women, and they came to him in a dream and told him the reason why we named the children that is that nobody should think like this people we could have gotten away with claiming that the children were fathered by Hashem. Who would think that nieces of Avraham Avinu would stoop so low as to be mezana with their own father? But we deliberately named them Moav, Me'av, and Ben Ami, so that nobody should ever think that a child could be fathered by Hashem, unlike what the Goyim did in later times. So it's a certain limud source on them. Moshe tells the whole story that he'd spoken very negatively about them, and then like his tongue swelled up and he could barely breathe, and when he realized that he's about to pass away, he called Moshe, the Rav, the Shtot Rav in, and told him what had just happened, and Moshe says, you see from this that there were people that were Baalei Ruach HaKodesh in that town of Laban in Russia, yeah. Yom Yom Mashiach Gola, Chof Tishrei. In Shulchan Aruch it says, in Hilchos Shabbos, you're not allowed to clap on Shabbos or dance or various other things. Now, what about, it says, nowadays people do that. So the one reason is Mutter Shiyu Shogigin. People are not going to listen anyway, so you might as well allow them to do it, because when things did Abonon, especially we say, that better let them be Shogig rather than Mazid if they're not going to listen anyway. And Yeshoimim, that Bizman Azeh, it's all Mutter, as it goes to talk about in Shulchan Aruch, the technicalities, why it should be Mutter. So now the Rebbe points out in the Sicha, we see by Chassidim, we see it by the Rebbeim, that we do lachatchila, we clap and we dance on Shabbos and Yom Tov. So now you have the technical halachic reasons that are there in Shulchan Aruch, but the real deeper reason is because we're coming closer to the time of Mashiach Tzidkenu. So we act like David HaMelech, David Mechauke B'chol Oz, Lifnei Hashem. He's dancing and singing and then jumping around and everything in honor of Hashem, and therefore we do the same thing on Shabbos and Yom Tov as well. Many times we know at Sabrengans also many times the Rebbe would have them whistle on Shabbos also, even though the poskim also are not so comfortable with the idea of whistling on Shabbos. But yeah, it's all part of this thing. Okay. Some relevant halachas about Sukkos and about the Shinar Abba and all. Let's see. So tonight we stay up all night, we do the Seder of it, because b'chag midonim al hamayim, human life depends on water, so it's the last day of the Yom Tov, akol elachat hachitum. When you get down to it, on Hashanah Rabbah, most of the extra Hashanahs that we're saying are about water.
So actually, I saw something where it was pointed out, you know, so you have a person goes and davens and says all those Hashanahs, give us water, Tana, Emunim, Shechim, Lechol, Lev, Tamayim, and then you go outside and you say, oh, what lousy weather. It's like a Tauti Desastri, kind of. So Taka should realize what a gift rain is. Then we take the Arabis, we beat them. Technically, the Arabis can be missing even most of their leaves. Strictly speaking, the Gemara says it can be even Ola Echad, Bavad Echad, one leaf on each stem. But the Hidra Mitzvah that should have lots of leaves. As we know, all the ones that we buy around Crown Heights are like that. By night, Leil Shmini Atzeres, you wait to make Kiddush until the night. You say Shechiyonu because it's regular b'fnei atzmai, no Leishah b'sukkah, because we're sitting in the sukkah because of Sfeika d'yoma, but we're not going to say Leishah b'sukkah because since we're saying in Kiddush and in davening, Shmini Atzeres achagazeh, it would be tauti disasri. It would be contradictory to be saying Shmini Atzeres achagazeh and also be saying Leishah b'sukkah. So to sit in the sukkah itself, we can use the excuse that we like the nice cool outdoors, and we can use the excuse that we like to sit out in the rain, but to actually make the bracha on it, that we can't do. Then comes later on Shmini Atzeres, you can start taking the furniture and all back inside, but not in the middle of the day, because that would be Mechin Miyom Tov L'Chaveres. You can do it close to you. You can do it in the evening when it's already the second day, or close to that.